From Vox Markets, I'm Anita Riota. Welcome to the inaugural episode of Spotlight, a new podcast series that sheds light on sectors, trends, and innovations that the market has largely overlooked. Spotlight connects with changemakers to examine how fresh ideas, innovative approaches, and unexpected breakthroughs could soon present real investment opportunities. From scientists on the brink of pivotal discoveries to entrepreneurs challenging the status quo, our guests will let us in on how they are shaping the futures of their respective industries. Spotlight is co-produced by Francesca Morgan and myself. Today, we take a look at the highly complex yet undeniably booming cannabis market. Regulations regarding cannabis legalization in the EU are rapidly changing. In just November of this year, the UK allowed doctors to write prescriptions for medicinal cannabis, and Luxembourg became the first EU country to legalize cannabis for recreational use. An industry report estimates that in 10 years' time, the total cannabis market could be worth over £100 billion. Yet, with uncertainty regarding legalization and a public stigma that remains hard to shake, some are wary to take part in what one of our guests has called the cowboy moment of cannabis. So we reached out and talked with cannabis experts, from growers to consultants and investors, to separate fact from fiction in this fickle, nascent, yet ever-growing market. Getting into our research, we saw that a lot of talent in the cannabis industry is coming from some very traditional fields, from consultants to policymakers. So our first question in learning more about the cannabis market was, how exactly do you find your way into it? Former trader David Burden is at the fore of the current revolution for the perception of cannabis, having entered the CBD market with an emphasis on personal well-being. His company, the London Botanists, focuses to remove the uncertainty and stigma attached to cannabis-related products.
So back in 2010, I slipped a disc in my back, and up until recently, my back would go every few months. But with the use of Pilates and CBD, I'm back on the road again. So for me, doing Pilates and moving into the CBD world has been a very natural progression. And I saw the American market is much more developed than ours. And I wanted to help the UK market by taking the uncertainty out of buying cannabis related products.
Hadley Ford is the CEO of Ianthus Capital, and he is revitalizing the sector by providing valued infrastructure and resources for the cannabis entrepreneur. He left the traditional world of finance to go look for the next big thing.
My background is really one of banking and healthcare. I spent the back half of the 80s at Fidelity, most of the 90s at Goldman Sachs, both on the principal investing side and the banking side. And I left that about four-ish years ago looking for the next big growth opportunity. And I got a phone call from a fellow I'd done a lot of business with when I was at Goldman. He said, what are you up to? Told him the story I just told you. And I said, I was looking for the next big thing. And he said, I found the next big thing. And he was founder of a company called IGE, which was the largest virtual currency trader at the time before anyone could actually spell Bitcoin. So when he said he'd found the next big thing, my expectation was to hear about ones and zeros. Instead, you can guess the punchline. He says, cannabis. I laugh. He says, why are you laughing? I said, well, it's kind of the family business. He said, well, why aren't you in the family business? I said, I don't really know what the national scalable model would look like. He said, well, we're two smart guys. We liked working with each other. Let's figure that out. You know, long story short, what we determined was the cannabis entrepreneur in the United States had no access to what we called regular way capital. Citibank wasn't going to give anyone a prime plus two loan for their grow. The second component was because the money wasn't flowing in, none of the usual infrastructure and resources available to an entrepreneur were available. So you didn't have banks, lawyers, you didn't have employees leaving Procter & Gamble to come run your marketing for you. And we thought, well, that's a pretty interesting idea.
Roy Bingham, a former McKinsey consultant, founded BDS Analytics after he recognized that the emerging cannabis industry totally lacked the kind of sophisticated sales-based data that allows other sectors to flourish. As CEO of BDS Analytics, Roy and his team have made their data collection the standard for the industry, and they are now the official data partner of the National Cannabis Industry Association.
So, yes, I was very respectable. I was actually a banker here in London before I even went to the US. I went to Harvard Business School, went to McKinsey, all of those traditional things. Then I started a series of businesses focused on the natural foods industry. So I became a little bit alternative. And then 4 years ago, I got started in the cannabis industry. And actually, I also had a get-together of Harvard Business School colleagues, and they were all very supportive. It was quite fascinating, actually. They were all rather excited for me. And it turned out, of course, that they were all pretty much consumers as well. So no, I haven't really encountered any stigma. I did look at it 6 years ago and decided it was too scary, dangerous at that time. I didn't really understand the industry. It seemed like too much of a risk for me with my career.
What changed between 6 years ago and when you decided to take the leap?
Yeah, so Colorado legalized for adult use, and I met a number of people in the adult use industry in Colorado and realized that they were just typical business people, and I suddenly became comfortable.
George McBride comes at the cannabis market from a policy perspective. Well-versed in the international intricacies surrounding drug regulation and reform, George is now the founder and CEO of Hanway Associates, providing bespoke consultancy services to clients working in the cannabis industry.
The policy work that I did at the Beckley and elsewhere has been hugely impactful on the way in which we go about our business with the consultancy. Obviously, the regulations and laws that govern the cannabis industry are one of the major, the major issue facing the industry, obviously, with blanket prohibition having been the norm for so long, and now different jurisdictions experimenting with how to regulate cannabis right from its cultivation through to what products can be processed and manufactured and who they can be sold to and where they can be sold. That kind of understanding of policy helps understand what opportunities there are in the industry, where trends are likely to emerge, how regulations are likely to evolve.
It's undeniable that public attitudes towards cannabis are critical to how it will behave as an emerging market. For years, its stigmatization has shrouded cannabis with feelings of fear and uncertainty. So, our next question was, how exactly has public perception evolved? Where is it currently? And what do they see looking ahead?
People still see cannabis as a threat and don't understand the difference between hemp and marijuana. But I think generally people are beginning to realize the health benefits of the plant, and it's starting to shake its stigma that was given to it during prohibition in the 1930s, the marijuana prohibition, where they made films such as Reefer Madness, and they said, this plant is coming up from Mexico, this marijuana, it's going to cause you to go out and kill your wife and, you know, all these things. I mean, I see more aggression from people drinking alcohol than taking THC, for example.
This plant, which is one of the most versatile plants with the most different medical, recreational, industrial applications, is now being brought into the light, having been banned in certain parts of the world over 100 years ago. It's missed out on all of these advances we've had with biotech and research. And unfortunately, the people who did still have a passion for the plant during prohibition were starved of the tools to investigate it.
Yeah, so about 5 years ago, the market really got going in Colorado, and it was just a bag of weed, basically. Mm. So people were just purchasing flour, and they were purchasing, you know, an eighth of an ounce, for example, and that was going to be handed to them in a little bag. But there was the beginnings of branded product. Mm. And it seemed likely to me that both concentrates and edibles would become quite popular. A lot of people don't want to start smoking. Many people have avoided smoking their whole life. And then to start smoking flower would be strange. So they're skipping over and going to concentrates. However, nobody had any data on what percentage of the market was flower versus the fledgling concentrate and edibles products that were available at that time. And in fact, there was a lot of misinformation. People were saying that edibles represented half the market in Colorado, which seemed very unlikely just based on surveys of stores. And what we discovered eventually was that it was about 15% of sales in the market. Mm. The reason we got to do what we did was that nobody had any real facts and figures on which type of concentrates are trending well, which types of edibles are becoming popular. And so we pulled in data from hundreds of dispensaries and categorized it and organized it. We've now processed 1 billion transactions Wow. through our system. And so we now have a really clear idea, not just of which categories and subcategories are popular, but which individual brands and which items and what price point are they selling for, what attributes do they have. That's all essential information if you're in the sales and marketing.
Do you think this centralized data has an effect on public perception?
Yeah, I think it's had multiple effects. I mean, the first one is just uncertainty and clarity of information takes away doubt. And so what we were able to do was define the size of the industry in North America first. And the trend, the growth rate, and items like, you know, understanding that edibles don't represent half of the market. Mm-hmm. That was important. A lot of politicians were concerned that the edibles were attractive to children, for example. So we cast a lot of light onto those sorts of topics. Then we also do a lot of consumer survey work, and we understand who the consumers of these products are. And we put out a lot of information about the fact that the consumers are normal, everyday people. They're not the stoner who lives, you know, in mum's basement and is 26 years old and still, you know, sleeps on the couch. It turns out that the consumers are every type of person. Age, gender is very typical of the average American mm-hmm. consumer, for example. And that suddenly destigmatizes mm-hmm. things. And then we've been to Washington, D.C., lobbying and bringing information to the politicians. And you gradually see them becoming a bit more understanding that this isn't some strange and scary industry. This is actually an industry that grew out of medical needs for consumers. And a lot of people are actually treating conditions successfully with cannabis and now has expanded into this adult use market mm-hmm. where people are using the product both for recreational purposes, but also very often to treat some kind of medical condition.
Back in the 60s, my parents actually grew some cannabis on the small family farm that we had. I still remember the day the local neighborhood kids stole a bunch of it. And my father was like, I can't even call the cops. So it did grow up. There was a lot of familiarity around the plant. But still, I can remember years later now, and we're trying to put together the company, and I went up to see my sisters grow. And I remember walking into it and just feeling very anxious, like looking over my shoulder, expecting to see DEA agents come in. So I can't imagine, you know, as someone who has no problem or issues with it, you know, my family's been involved in it for years. I can't imagine how the average person must feel. But that's why I'm so bullish on the industry. You know, we look today and we say, well, there's probably a $50 or $60 billion market, you know, sort of retail dollars changing hands between the illegal market and legal market.
I think the current policies, pessimistic and not optimistic, are somewhat of a dead end. But that in itself isn't the problem. The dial on public perception around cannabis has shifted dramatically and continues to shift. The perceptions have moved from, you know, that this is something that is innately bad for your health and will demotivate you and wreck your life, towards something that this is a plant that has a whole range of medical applications that can really improve people's lives if it's used in the right way. And that's the important thing. Meanwhile, the government have focused far too much on any risk that products could be diverted to people who are going to use it for non-medical purposes. They've thought that that is a much bigger concern than providing access to those people who have a genuine medical need. So it's almost impossible to get access to cannabis-based medical products in the UK at the moment, and will probably remain so until at least October 2019, when NICE, the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, will release their guidelines, which could open up prescriptions, which at the moment are only allowed to be written by consultants, so that they could be written by GPs. There's also a whole other raft of technical details in the guidelines surrounding this law, which has restricted it. But the good thing, being optimistic, is it's the guidelines that are restrictive, not the law. They could have come out and set in stone legal restrictions, and they didn't. So I feel like this is the first iteration of these regulations, and the next iteration of the regulations will be driven by the public demand. Hopefully we'll see another campaign leading to greater demand for better access, rather than evolving from the regulations as they are now.
Regulation, or a lack thereof, clearly lies at the heart of whether or not cannabis will become a thriving market. So we asked our guests to characterize the current state of regulation in their regions, and whether they believe full legalization is inevitable.
There's a limit on the levels of THC that are allowed in the oil, which we think makes sense. And the main issue on the legislation for us is not being able to mention the medicinal benefits of the oil, which limits the amount of information we're allowed to share. And it's frustrating for us, as there are a lot of people out there that the oil could help, but we're not allowed to tell them about it. And we're also not allowed to tell our customers how best to take the oil, depending on their particular ailment. We can't advise them there. And they have to do their own research. And there's a lot of stuff out there you have to sift through, whether what's true and what isn't. And it just adds another unnecessary hurdle. So fortunately for us, there are no reported side effects of the oil, which we believe makes it extremely safe to use. And we can just say that it supports health, which is neither descriptive nor informative.
I think that the legalization in one form or another of the plant across the majority of the Western world is inevitable. And I think even people on the other side of the argument to me think that. And most of the rows that I have with people who are anti-legalization these days are rowing with me because they are convinced of the inevitability of the rise of big cannabis, and that every country is going to legalize it, and that this is a terrible thing. They are arguing that it should be prohibited, but they're arguing that from a position of assuming that it will be legalized very soon. And public attitudes have shifted dramatically. Take the UK. We did polling in early 2017 through Voltfast, the campaigning organisation we used to work at. And 43% of the public were in support of legalising cannabis for recreational purposes. And then Populous and Voltfast did the polling again last month, and it's up to 59%. In the USA, support for federal legalization of cannabis is at 68% and is one of the only issues in the US where you have bipartisan support. A majority of Republicans and a majority of Democrats both support the legalization of this.
Yeah, you know, I don't think there'll be some kind of final push. I think you'll have, just continual what we call pebbles on the scale. There'll be sort of one piece after another. I think that can be accelerated. People could put a rock on the scale. And I came to the UK about 6 months ago. You know, it was sort of a first investor trip because we'd heard there'd been some interest over here. And there was a lot of glassy-eyed stares. You know, what's going on in the US? And now I'm here this week, and the ramp up in understanding and sophistication of the investors is remarkable. You know, the learning curve and kind of grow across the bottom of the bathtub and then you cycle straight up. You know, that took a couple of years in Canada. It's taken about 6 or 7 months in the UK. So my guess is the commercial aspects of licensure and medical and full rec are probably going to go that much faster as well. It took a long time for Canada to get there. And then, the United States is speeding up, and I think all these other countries will go even faster.
We're already seeing parts of the UK experiment in Jersey and Guernsey. They're looking at allowing GPs to prescribe medical cannabis, which will make it far easier for people to access what is quite a low risk, safe range of products, which a lot of people are, you know, up to 1 million people in the UK are already using cannabis for medical purposes. Mm-hmm. And at the moment they're using stuff of unknown provenance, potency, purity. And that, I think, should be the driving concern for regulators rather than a fear around diversion.
Well, I think consumer attitudes are much further along in the United States at the present time than the UK. We've had medical markets in Maine and in California since 1993. We've had adult use markets in Colorado for 5 years now, for example, and in Washington and Oregon for 4 years. And so people in those states are very familiar with cannabis. They're not afraid that it turns people crazy or that it has adverse health effects or even that it's addictive, for example. Mm. When I talk to people in the UK, they're very focused on the medical benefits, which is great, but they're also concerned about effects or consequences that might be harmful that have been disproved for the large part in the United States. Mm. So education has a way to go over here in the UK. Yeah. And of course, you know, because it's been prohibited in so many countries for so long, there's been very little research actually going on. Research has just kicked off really in the United States now. There's significant research in Israel and in Australia. But that's really the large majority of what's been done up to now, and very little, if anything, in the UK since, you know, the 1950s. I came to the UK 6 months ago, and there was talk about a possible change. Mm. And all of a sudden, bingo, you know, the law's changing and there's a medical market in the UK. When we look at the European markets, you just look at the population, the GMP, the current expenditure in the illicit market, and you're doing the math and you say, okay, it's likely a $60 to $100 billion market in Europe as well. Wow. And that's why people are so excited about the opportunity from a financial standpoint. Right. It creates a very substantial, it's already a very substantial industry. It's just under the table and therefore not taxed, not regulated, right, not licensed, and not as safe for the consumer as it will be when it is properly regulated.
And I caught a strong emphasis on the will there. Do you see legalization as an inevitability?
Yes, I almost certainly do, yes. Mm. Prohibition is ending globally. We're even seeing countries in Asia that you would never have thought would be passing laws for medical cannabis, getting ready to pass laws right now.
With so little known about the potential of cannabis as a legitimate market, we needed to understand how predictions about the cannabis market were quantified, whether it was being overhyped or truly on the precipice of an international boom.
Well, there's probably a $50 or $60 billion market in sort of retail dollars changing hands between the illegal market and legal market. And that probably represents maybe an 11-ish% penetration of adults who use cannabis on a regular basis, defined as twice a month. Our supposition is that 10 years from now, that's going to look a lot more like alcohol, where you've got about a 55 or 60% penetration rate of the adult population. So there's an opportunity for this to become a $200 billion market over the next 10 years. And a lot of that is around familiarity and the reduction of the stigma associated with it. As you get federal legality, as dispensaries open in major cities, I think there will become much more awareness, both on the medical benefits, but also on the recreational side as a substitute for, you know, some people's vices today. And, you know, entrepreneurs typically come and play that role and make sure that consumers or patients actually have access to, you know, well-priced, high-quality products and try and delight them in any fashion they can. And I think that's what we're seeing. The interesting thing in the U.S. cannabis market is that it's wide open for entrepreneurs as opposed to sort of the big businesses because of the federal illegality of it. You know, kind of the big alcohol, big tobacco, big pharma, big retailers are on the sidelines right now. And it's a tremendous opportunity for companies such as ours to go in and make shareholders happy with wealth creation.
Well, we quantify the current legal U.S. market. And last year, we estimated $9 billion in sales. And we can be very precise about 80% of that because we're actually tracking those transactions in 80% of the United States. So about a $9 billion market legally in the United States. And this year it'll be about 12 billion. So it's growing at about 28%. Now, the total market, including illicit, is probably a $60 to $70 billion market. Okay.
Wow.
Cannabis legally is new. Cannabis is not new. Consumers in America, 23% of the US population have consumed in the last 6 months, irrespective of what state they live in, irrespective of where they purchased it from. In the states where it is adult use legal, 32% of the adult population have consumed in the last 6 months.
There's a couple of things. I think, you know, one, it's still illegal at the federal basis, so there is risk. You know, I think it's exceptionally volatile. And I think we're really just at the beginning of that transfer from the illegal market to the legal market. You know, we're going to see tremendous changes over the next 5 to 10 years. You know, as it goes towards full legality at the federal level, and you get, you know, the 1,500 food scientists from Procter & Gamble involved in figuring out what products can be invented and sold, you know, you're going to see things that we can never dream of. I mean, even today, you know, it's crazy the products you can see that are being developed. You know, 4 years ago, you know, most cannabis cup competitions didn't even have a piece for oil. And, you know, now it's just dominating, and that's sort of the big growth area of the business. And I think you'll see other products and whatnot come out with all the ingenuity you get, and it's going to be a completely different industry. That's why I'm pretty confident it moves from, you know, kind of 10-12% penetration today to close to 50-60% penetration 10 years from now. Just, you know, it's a plant that really hasn't been studied and developed. It's just sort of been shunted into the back alleys for 80 years.
Our target clients are really the brands within the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, of the top 50 brands in the United States, 2/3 of them are our clients already. They're using the data to figure out what their market share is, which categories are most attractive for them to create new products in, who are their leading competitors. Mm-hmm. And in order to launch new campaigns, new marketing strategies, and new products, for example. Now, investors also, of course, now want to know who are the leading brands and what are the trends within the industry. So we provide macro-level data for investors. You know, how big is it? It's growing at a 27% compound growth rate projected for the next 5 years by us. And so that's a benchmark for investors to think about.
If you look at the fact that the CBD market's only £50 million, then there's clearly a long way to go. And what I do know is that the resurgence of cannabis and hemp is not just a trend, it's revolution and a rebellion against being blindly told what to put inside our bodies by Big Pharma.
And then there was an issue that kept coming up that neither of us even knew to ask about at first. And that was this debate about the liberalization versus commercialization of the cannabis industry. And essentially, at the center of this contention was, what role should big pharmaceutical companies be given in this burgeoning market?
Yeah, I think, you know, most people that I know in the industry have some personal story on what attracted them to it. You know, my own is, you know, I think that individuals should have the ability to do whatever the heck they want with their body, and that includes ingesting cannabis. So as I put it in the vernacular, I'd like to stick it to the man, except then my youngest daughter says, Dad, you are the man, which is, you know, in and of itself a little sobering. But I think, you know, that then quickly manifests itself into the business aspects of it.
I think that's an interesting question. There's probably like a few aspects to this, and it depends on whether you're talking about THC or CBD. And if you refer to like the US market at the moment, there's I read a stat the other day saying that the value of the pharmaceutical industry is around $5 billion. And with the advent of THC, they reckon that that's going to wipe $1 billion off the value of the market, because THC can, they're saying it can be used to replace opioids. And it can also be used to get people to come off opioids. And there's an opioid crisis in America at the moment.
Yeah, well, there's certainly opposition to the status quo. You know, this is an industry that is evolving rapidly from having been prohibited. Mm-hmm. Millions of people have gone to jail for consuming cannabis in tiny quantities or for carrying it in tiny quantities. Now that it's being legalized in various states, a lot of the legal records are being expunged, and that is a really important development for people. So there's definitely an animosity towards the way the plant has been treated up to now. And people perceive the pharmaceutical industry to be part of that status quo. And the fact is that in Arizona, they didn't pass adult use 2 years ago. And the main reason was that one of the pharmaceutical companies that is a leading opioid company put a couple of million dollars into the no campaign in order to try and stop it.
Well, one thing I am concerned about is with regulation is that big pharma will find a way to manipulate the cannabinoids, and only medicinal compounds will be sold. So, but we hope that there is a liberalization of cannabis rather than a commercialization that lends itself to big pharma.
I think there is a real sense of people that they're being part of a pioneering positive social change, and I think that's great. But I think there also is a sense, more in America and less so here, about this kind of wellness anti-pharmaceutical sentiment, and I think some of that has been anti-intellectual and regressive, and I dislike that narrative about how, oh, we should just use plants. And there is a serious problem in the way in which the pharmaceutical industry does not spend money on investigating naturally occurring compounds because they can't make as much money out of them. And that is a huge issue that people should speak about a lot more, because there are cheap drugs all over the world that we could be using. But the pharmaceutical industry is not the devil. It's produced cures for innumerable diseases and improved human society and health exponentially over the last few decades, and it operates to incredible standards of intellectual rigor. And we should find a balance with cannabis and other plant-derived drugs. We shouldn't just try and eschew the whole pharmaceutical industry. We should bring them into this.
The capital into the industry is welcomed, but consolidating businesses may not necessarily create a much better situation for the consumer. In the Western United States, we see hundreds of dispensaries. Colorado has over 600 independent dispensaries, lots of mom and pop stores, as well as chains, for example. Now, in the Eastern United States, in states like Massachusetts that have recently legalized for adult use, and the other states like Florida that have legalized medical use, what we're seeing is very limited numbers of licenses being granted, and they're being granted to people who have a lot of capital, perhaps a lot of political connections as well, and certainly a lot of very good lawyers to help them with their application processes, etc. And so they're looking for those semi-monopolistic situations where they're the only dispensary in a particular town or city. And I'm not sure that that's in the best interest of the consumer in the long run. That may create a successful business. And ultimately, if those businesses are successful and they're innovative and they drive down costs, then ultimately the consumer may benefit. But I tend to think in capitalism, we like to see free market competition, and that's the way to get the best products for the consumer.
It's a good and bad thing, but also more importantly, it's an inevitability. We operate in a globalized capitalist system in which large institutions are able to operate at scales that give them competitive advantages and then are able to influence policies and regulations in their favor. That is just reality. So I think anybody expecting that cannabis legalization would just be the legalization of a kind of cottage industry while prohibiting the involvement of big business was just wishful thinking, really. I don't think there's any real way in doing that. Legalization means allowing everybody to get involved. And there are some real benefits to allowing larger institutions to get involved. It will probably expedite the legalization of cannabis in a lot more countries. It will drive a lot more talented people into the industry, which is a benefit. But also, obviously, there are some potential downsides. If they create barriers to entry in their own favor, which prohibit smaller players. But that's more a critique of society in general than it is anything cannabis specific.
Then there was the question that kicked this all off for us. Where is the cannabis market heading?
So we asked our guests to look ahead and tell us why exactly they see the cannabis market as a sector on the verge of a boom.
The business model is pretty straightforward. There's three components of success in the U.S. market today. The first is an ability to add to your footprint, and I'll come back to that in a moment. The second is ability to raise money in support of that footprint. And the third then is to be able to have a team that can replicate the same process over and over again. So let me touch on those three things. The footprint's exceptionally important. As I said previously, this could be as much as a $200 billion market 10 years from now. What could that be worth in the public markets? Well, if you're just a retailer, it's probably worth one times revenue or $200 billion of value. But because cannabis operators in the US are able to own not just the retail component, but the brand and the distribution as well, those types of companies, an InBev, a Constellation, trade at 5 to 6 times revenue in the public markets. You could have $1 trillion of market cap up for grabs in the United States 10 years from now.
We wouldn't have the business that we have without that multidisciplinary approach, and we've continued it in our hiring policy because the plant is so complicated in itself. It's got hundreds of different pharmacologically active compounds that all potentially have interactions with each other. Then you've got the complexity of all the laws and the policy, and then the complexity of the different ways in which it's used, the different cultural associations, misconceptions, baggage that comes with the plant. So if you don't have the ability to understand the industry and the plant from a whole range of different angles, then it's going to be very difficult to give people the kind of advice that people come to us for. I think the most important thing that we do, which sounds so simple as to be patronizing, but a lot of people don't do, is actually employ people from the country, which is such a simple thing that is missed out by so many of the multinational companies operating in this sector. They will bring talented people that they trust from home and then go and try and work on an issue that with cannabis is so deeply ingrained within the culture. And if you're bringing people from California over to Luxembourg, you're going to be clueless about the completely different misconceptions, preconceptions, attitudes towards cannabis that you have in localized areas in Europe. And geographically, it shifts so much. And it's not just the regulations, it's everything about the attitudes to the plant.
So one of the issues that we have in cannabis in the United States is you can't use a lot of the usual levers of education, right? There's no advertising allowed. If you're promoting cannabis on Facebook or any of the other big social media, they'll come in and shut you down. They'll kick you out. So the educational piece and reestablishing the familiarity for the consumer or the patient needs to be done in a retail environment, which means you have to make an investment in bricks and mortar. So it's the complete opposite of what's happening on retail and the rest of the world, where it's all moving away from bricks and mortar and moving to Jeff Bezos. In cannabis, you have to have that entree point. You know, the woman who is having trouble sleeping, she's not going to know the difference between a dab and a vape cart, or she's just not going to know. So how is she going to learn that? She might go online, but ultimately she has to come into a store, and that store better be well located with plenty of parking and educated sales force, and it better be light and inviting and delight her when she comes to the store. And the first time she may stay 20 minutes, the next time 10 minutes, the next time 2 minutes. Ultimately, that educational piece, she becomes a regular buyer from a patient or customer perspective. So that retail component, ironically, in this day and age, is very, very important for that educational process to the customer.
What do you think? I mean, it's obviously hard to boil down to one issue, but what do you think the key is to helping propel this sort of wave of legalization? Is it something that needs to happen in the consumer side of things? Is it something that the industry needs to handle better? What do you think is sort of, if you could pick one thing, it's going to push this along.
It's you. It's young people that are making it happen.
It's specifically me.
Well, it's anyone under my age. I'm 56. I grew up in an era where there was a lot of miseducation about cannabis. So I wasn't exactly there, you know, in the 1940s when all that nonsense was coming out, and in the 50s and 60s with Nixon, et cetera. But there was an overhang. My parents had heard all of that and said, oh, cannabis is going to make you crazy, you know. And then the next generation, though, have not heard any of that nonsense. And in fact, they've heard facts and figures. They've had their own personal experiences. They've seen also that, you know, alcohol has more serious consequences mm-hmm. for consumers, tobacco, all sorts of other things that have been legal for all these years. I mean, let's face it, caffeine is more addictive than cannabis is. Sugar is more addictive than cannabis is. There's a lot of argument that says sugar does way more damage to people as well. And so your generation is making its own mind up. And when we look at the data for the US, for example, 80% of Americans are now in favor of some form of legal cannabis. If you look at that data harder, the naysayers are dying. They're the people in their 70s and 80s and 90s. And so when you look at the younger people, it's almost universal. Everybody is basically saying, I don't understand why this product is not legally available.
Yeah, there's a certain cowboy nature to it, you know, that's attractive, right? Big growth opportunity, and the rules haven't been written, and there's not a lot of competition from the usual suspects. That's very exciting. Now, make no mistake, I mean, it's a real business. You know, anyone who thinks you're going to come in and, you know, grow a money tree, they're in for a rude awakening. You know, this is, you have to grow well, you have to process well, you have to have good products. You have to have an inviting environment for your customers. You know, basically, you're in three or four different businesses within one. And I can't think of any analogs to where you need to be a farmer, a scientist, and a retailer all at once.
I just think there has to be a lot more medical studies done, and they're quite expensive to do. And hopefully, more and more will come out, and the market will move on.
Now what we're seeing is that a lot of pharmaceutical companies are saying, wait a minute, no, this is an area of tremendous opportunity. We haven't had the chance to work on cannabinoids, though there's so much data to show that it is effective for various different conditions. And what I'm hearing is that dozens of pharmaceutical companies have research going on. There are about 10 or a dozen pure play pharmaceutical companies that are developing a specific cannabis product and have nothing else, but all of the major companies are now looking at it very seriously as ways to enhance their existing drugs, as well as to develop a completely new set of drugs.
There's no getting away from the fact that CBD is on trend, and there is a big market for it. It's such a positive thing, and with the movement towards wellness, I don't see it going anywhere anytime soon.
Thank you for tuning in to our first episode of Spotlight, and we'd like to thank our wonderful guests who took the time to share their knowledge with us. So thank you, George McBride, Rory Bingham, David Burden, and Hadley Ford.
Join us next time when we'll be speaking to female entrepreneurs in the flourishing femtech industry about what it means to innovate a sector that has been stagnant for decades.